Welcome to LSE for this public event. My name is Jim Walters. I'm a professor in practice in the Department of International Relations here, to whom we're very grateful for hosting and organising this event. And I'm director of the LSE Faith Centre and our Religion and Global Society Research Unit. Interfaith work is at the heart of what we do. RGS has, in the last year, facilitated dialogue between young Muslim and Coptic clergy in Egypt about collaboration on climate change, and between women peace activists from Israel and Palestine. And the Faith Centre itself promotes religious literacy and interfaith engagement here at LSE, and our extracurricular Beacon Faith and Leadership programme has become more and more popular among students coming from parts of the world where they recognise religion as being integral to both the conflicts and challenges, but also the opportunities that their societies face. And we have much discussion in that programme among students about how they can go on to implement their learning in their possible future careers. How can they bring together religious and political forces in ways that don't further instrumentalize religion or overstate its influence? How can they harness state-level interest in this work without colluding in Western-oriented PR exercises by essentially authoritarian regimes? These kinds of questions. And how can we navigate these questions in a region like the Middle East, the great crossroads, ground zero even, of the Abrahamic faiths, where the distinctions between the religious and the political are themselves more blurred than here in the West? And then how do we begin to even ask these questions today, when the interreligious tensions of the region have become so inflamed since 7th of October? Well, I'm delighted that to launch that discussion, we have this amazing panel. We have Michael Dreesen, who will be talking about his recent book, The Global Politics of Interreligious Dialogue. Michael is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs and Director of the MA program in International Affairs at John Cabot University, based in Rome. He's going to present for half an hour or so. And then we have two respondents, Professor Madawi Al-Rashid and Professor Fabio Petito. Madawi is visiting professor at the Middle East Centre here at the LSE and a fellow of the British Academy. And Fabio is returning to LSE, a PhD student here, but now Professor of Religion and International Affairs and Professor of International Relations in the School of Global Studies at the University of Sussex. So they'll have a little discussion following Michael's presentation, and then we will hand over to you to hear your questions to the panel. For those Twitter users, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSEIR. The event is being recorded and will be available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. So, I hope you'll join with me in welcoming the panel and particularly handing over to Michael.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me in the back? Yeah, it's okay. All right. I'm going to try without the microphone a little bit here, but well, welcome. It's so good to see so many faces here, and I'm glad you've come out tonight. And I want to thank James, but also my colleagues, Fabio and Madawi, and to the LSC, Religion and Global Society, and really everyone here tonight who helped to promote this. Kathy as well, if she's around, she's been fantastic. Ah, yes, Kathy, yes, thank you. There she is. So what I thought I would do this evening, so as James says, I've got about half an hour. I'm gonna start by presenting my book, some of the big themes that I try to explore in the book. And then I want to use about 10 minutes to speak to the title of our event and reflect a little bit about what this might mean for the region today, how the landscape has changed, and what role that leaves for religion and diplomacy, if we tag it like that. So let me begin with the book. Let's see if there it is. All right. So the book explores the rise of state-sponsored interreligious dialogue initiatives across the broader Middle East over the last two decades, and it tries to interpret their political meaning. As many of you know, many of you might not know, the last 15 years have seen tremendous growth of a range of state-based religious initiatives, interreligious initiatives in the region. You have the creation of centers like Qaiseed in Saudi Arabia, DSEED in Doha, and the Abu Dhabi Forum for Peace. You have the engagement of important religious bodies like Al-Azhar and the Muslim World League in interreligious and initiatives, and you have a series of very important declarations like the Human Fraternity Document, the Marrakesh Declaration, the Al-Azhar Declarations, and a common word letter. So I read this as a wave, as a period of concentrated growth. And I'm just gonna throw up some of these initiatives so you can see them up there today. 10-year period since the early 2000s of growth in interreligious initiatives in the region. And when I first started this project, on the one hand, it seemed clear to me that these initiatives represented a new kind of institutional strategy that was being adopted by states and international actors to formally engage with religious communities in the region in a post 9/11 world. Almost all of these initiatives come after 9/11. And in order to emphasize this policy component, the way which this represents some form of religion and diplomacy, both myself, Fabio, and others have tried to tag these policy-related interreligious initiatives, state-sponsored interreligious initiatives, as forms of interreligious engagement to distinguish that policy element. At the same time, however, it also seemed clear to me that these initiatives were connected to broader religious and social dynamics in the region, as well as innovative theological and religious activity by a number of actors. Groups like the Community of San Egidio, if you're familiar with them, or the Adyen Foundation in Lebanon, the Gulen community to some degree, the Focolare community in Algeria, groups whose creative interreligious experiences from below the book also tries to introduce and make some sort of meaning of them. So there was clearly a geostrategic impulse to these initiatives, but they also seem to have developed over time genuine religious and political content, and they were drawing on genuine religious and social practices and aspirations in order to do so. And in order to make sense of these multiple layers at work in these interreligious dialogue activities, the book tries to build a theoretical framework which incorporates three levels of analysis focused on considerations of political power, which are behind these initiatives, ideas and theological, religious and political ideas, and social and religious practices, which are all at work in these initiatives. Now, these three dimensions are sometimes in tension with one another, but they're also inevitably connected. And one of the ways in which I read them as being connected is that all three can be linked somehow, I believe, to the evolving response by multiple actors to ongoing crises of liberal democracies and the liberal international system which they had constructed, as especially manifested in a crisis of social solidarity at both the domestic and the international level of politics. These crises have promoted what is often tagged in our field as new post-secular thinking about the role of religion in politics and new post-secular accounts of global politics, which the book draws on in its theoretical framework and in many ways builds on prior work that Fabio Petito and others have done on this topic. In adopting this approach, one of my goals here has been to tie the growth of interreligious dialogue in the region within larger processes of global religious change. Within this perspective, the recent evolution of dialogue in the Middle East can be seen to be not just unique to Islam, but rather part of global religious development in response to globally experienced dynamics of modernity. And I think these developments are not really even new, but really part of the longer historical struggle of religious communities, traditions, and peoples to construct and then reconstruct alternative and distinctive religious syntheses or religious readings of modernity. So that's a little bit about the broader research project, and this is my broad sort of religious argument. What I'm gonna do is just briefly say something about these layers and then reflect on what that might mean for the region today. So let me start with this first level of analysis, which is that of geopolitics, state interests, the IR of interreligious dialogue. So in political science, recent work on interreligious initiative religions has been especially focused on questions about state interests and power dynamics, which seem to be driving these institutions forward. And in fact, the growth of state-sponsored dialogue and initiatives in the region could be seen as a concrete attempt by policymakers to craft new relationships with religious actors and communities, both on account of a perceived increase in security threats having to do with religion in a post 9/11 world, but also in a post ISIS or Daesh world, but also at the same time, a growing acceptance of a position that directly engaging religious actors was necessary for the achievement of a range of political and humanitarian goals, whether or not be in conflict resolution, the ecology, sustainable development, the COVID crisis, or you have it. In a number of these political science accounts, the growth of interreligious dialogue has also been seen as the result of the broader impulse of the modern nation state to manage, domesticate, and control religion and other social forces. This is what Elizabeth Shackman Heard refers to as the big R religion problem, that through interreligious dialogue, states and international organizations have begun to construct what might be dubbed as a global religious engagement regime, sort of the global religion and diplomacy apparatus, which legitimizes and establishes certain religious authorities and narratives while simultaneously excluding and delegitimizing others, often at the expense of what Shackman Heard would refer to as the little r everyday religious communities and peoples. For the United States and Europe, and a number of international organizations, these interreligious initiatives and the formalization of new diplomatic positions which have gone along with it. Here I'm thinking especially about special envoys abroad for religious freedom or for interreligious dialogue in places like the United States, the UK, the UN, the EU, Italy. These are positions that have to do with religion that in our international organizations, which we did not have 20 years ago. And they have begun to serve in some ways as a pseudo or proto ministry of religious affairs for the international system. For regimes in the region, these dialogue initiatives have also been useful for states to manage and promote certain religious authorities and narratives, but also to utilize religion as a form of statecraft, to accumulate soft power and extend or manage geopolitical competition and goals. And here, states like Qatar and the UAE are very important examples here. I'm just gonna put this slide up here and say something about it in a second. Now, this strategic logic has led to a certain pervasive skepticism, particularly within political science, about interreligious engagement. There's the worry that it is or has been easily instrumentalized by state actors to manage religious actors and communities and vice versa. And we have the common criticism that these interreligious initiatives simply function as a form of religion washing. You may be familiar with the term sports washing. So this is a criticism about religion washing, which is to say that it's a convenient public distraction from authoritarian politics in the region. And in this sense, as the slide sort of tries to visually piece together, a number of critics have connected the dots between the Abraham Accords and the dialogue policies of the United Arab Emirates, particularly in its important outreach that it did to Jewish and Christian scholars and communities, which somehow helped to prepare the way for the normalization of relations between Israel and the UAE in 2020. So you have the 2020 Abraham Accords. Before that, you had the 2019 Human Fraternity Document, which this massive moment when Pope Francis comes and visits the Arab Peninsula for the first time. And you have the Abrahamic Family House, which was opened up as a result of that meeting. And the Abrahamic Family House, which was inaugurated after the 2020 Abraham Accords, but was prepared already beforehand, was already being built beforehand, built on this island in Abu Dhabi, a temple, a Christian church, and a mosque all together. In this example, the state actually fashions somehow religious content, at least in this story. Now, I think that this argument, the geopolitical argument, is important but also insufficient. And that by itself, this bare bones geopolitical analysis misses other dimensions at work in these initiatives, including particularly the political and religious ideas and practices which they are developing and bringing forward. So we have to dig further into the substrata. I'm from a Mediterranean city, and there's always substrata upon substrata, and they don't always add up into the same level of culture. So here, taking a closer look at this content of the arc of recent declarations and religious declarations initiatives in the region brings into focus other elements of what I argue is part of a longer effort within Islam and other religious traditions, global religious traditions, to respond to processes of modernization and all that has entailed, complex mixes of democratization, globalization, secularization, among other things. And here, beyond the geopolitics, therefore, we have to account for a long-run religious development at work, which has been pushed forward in important ways by the experience of violence, by 9/11 and ISIS, but also by democratic developments within the Middle East itself. And in the book, I use Asif Bayat's work on the emergence of post-Islamist sensibilities in the region, which I think remains very relevant and important in this regard. If I were to risk reducing this argument to a catchy phrase, we might say that while it's true that we can't understand the growth of interreligious engagement without reference to 9/11 or ISIS, we also can't understand it without taking account of the Arab Spring and the social and political aspirations for democracy and political rights and freedoms which animated it. And in the book, I focus especially here on the development within these declarations initiatives of what I call citizenship narratives, what is often referred to as inclusive or active or comprehensive citizenship, and what I talk about in the book as the dignity, freedom, citizenship principle. And the dignity, freedom, citizenship principle recognizes that all human beings have been created by God with equal and inviolable dignity, that such dignity requires a certain level of religious freedom, and that dignity and freedom both together need the development of a more inclusive and active practice of citizenship to be fully realized. This principle has been increasingly articulated and embraced by a number of theologians and religious actors in the region, and consistently shows up in development across these declarations. In the book, I trace the idea through the Amman message, the Common Word document, the Marrakesh Declaration, Al-Azhar statements, and the 2019 Human Fraternity document, among others. And here we see it especially illustrated here in the 2016 Marrakesh Declaration. The top part is actually the unabridged version, in which they make exactly the dignity, freedom, citizenship principle evident. God bestowed dignity on all human beings. This dignity requires that human beings must be granted freedom. And based on that, we call upon all Muslim scholars and intellectuals around the world to develop a jurisprudence of the concept of citizenship, which is inclusive of diverse groups. And one of the things I find interesting is how much this idea of inclusive or active citizenship has been embraced within recent interreligious narratives within the region as the solution to religious crises and religious pluralism. Faced with the question of violence against religious minorities, as the 2016 Marrakesh Declaration was responding to, of religious and political instability and conflict, the strengthening of citizenship rights and the support for citizenship formation has been increasingly posed as the answer, as a strong model of political and religious development which responds to those crises. And in the book, from a comparative religious perspective, I'm very struck here by parallels with earlier waves of adaptation by other global religious traditions, particularly the global Catholic Church in the 1960s through the Second Vatican Council. In important ways, this language, the language of dignity, freedom, citizenship, echoes the logic which was written to the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights and adopted at the Second Vatican Council, particularly in the encyclical Dignitas Humanae, and both of which bore the influence of Jacques Maritain and others' work on Christian humanism, and which helped open up the floodgates for democratic action and advocacy within Catholic modernity. So we see these ideas at work in the Human Fraternity document, which is the document that Pope Francis signed with Ahmed Al-Tayeb Al-Azhar in 2019. I want to just throw this slide up, and we see this connection between Christian humanism and Muslim humanism being made explicitly by the humanitarian Islam movement in Indonesia in 2019. The humanitarian Islam movement is a movement which was sponsored by Nahdlatul Ulema, which is lays claim to being the largest Muslim movement in the world. And they, in this resolution which they passed, make explicitly this this connection between what they call humanitarian Islam, dignity, freedom, and citizenship, and the tradition of Christian humanism and the tradition of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So in important ways, I read this body of actions and movements and ideas as representing a response to real, active, geopolitical, and social concerns, but also as striving to construct, in response, a credible and alternative vision of religious modernity. In this light, I think interreligious dialogue efforts in the region do represent a breakthrough, and an unexpected one. One which flips the narrative, so to speak, particularly if we consider the defensive posture which characterized a number of responses to Western portrayals of Islam in the early 2000s. These dialogue initiatives have helped to liberate religious authorities in the region to reclaim a positive public religious role in their support for citizen rights and religious reform. And I find something distinctively post-secular about this turn, the rediscovery of some necessary role for religion in post-modernity as a grounding for the rights and freedom and pluralism that moderns hold dear. And I think you see this especially with the use of human fraternity, or as is often posed in these declarations, of social cohesion. In these declarations, fraternity or solidarity or social cohesion is often argued to be the necessary flip side to freedom and diversity, and religion is proposed as offering a source for regenerating that solidarity, which is a classic position within the sociology of religion going back at least to Durkheim. But I emphasize that this also represents a rediscovery, and one that is being pushed forward, especially by the practical experience of groups within the region, groups like the Focolare movement in Algeria, the Adyan Foundation in Lebanon, which I explore in the book. And in explicit ways, as I analyze in the book, a number of the thinkers working around these declarations and around these experiences have been explicitly engaging with the work of Jürgen Habermas on your post-secularism, and particularly the concerns which he raises about declines in social solidarity over time in Europe and around the globe, and the possibilities for what he sees as transformed, maybe democratically transformed, and renewed religious forces might offer for regenerating solidarity and meaning for post-modernity. And in the book, I quote Habermas from his debate with future Benedict the 16th with Pope in 2005, that thus the theorem that only a religious orientation towards a transcendental reference point could help a remorseful modernity out of its impasse again finds residence today. So he has a sort of Habermas theorem. And I think interreligious dialogue and efforts in the region in many ways try to pose himself as an answer to this theorem. In this respect, I think that these religious actors and intellectuals are clearly making an argument that political crises in the region and globally represent a religious crisis, and therefore that political renewal requires religious renewal and the strengthening of religion's role in the public sphere, as the Human Fraternity Declaration itself argues. And in fact, much of the enthusiasm within official Islam today for dialogue and multi-religious cooperation, I think, must be understood within this perspective, as being perceived to be consonant with a project of religious renewal, one which does not threaten, but may even strengthen orthodox religious moral sensibilities within society. And that raises a number of interesting ambiguities, which characterize not just these dialogue initiatives, but I think a whole range of contemporary religious political projects, which also repropose religion as a stabilizing force within society. And I think of some of the post-liberalism or virtue ethics projects in this light. And this complicates the characterization of a breakthrough on dialogue and pluralism, which I think is correct, as simply a progressive move, which I don't think is the case. In other words, that coming to positive terms with modernity, with democracy, with plurality, can hold multiple valences and move in different directions, including in more conservative and liberal forms, and sometimes all at once. My colleague, Christina Stoeckel, has captured these tensions in what she refers to as the rediscovery of Article 29 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by conservative religious actors across the globe, and in her work, especially through the Russian Orthodox Church. Article 29, which I've put up here, includes a line about the duties of individuals to their community and the limitations to freedom set by the just requirements of morality, public order. Stoeckel argues that the rediscovery of Article 29 by the Russian Orthodox Church in the early 2000s offered them a key to unlock a religious and originalist understanding of human rights. If you want human rights, you need the religious roots of a human rights. This is many ways their discovery. In the process of doing so, the Russian Orthodox Church transformed itself from a religious outfit which was caught on the defense and into a forward-posturing norms pioneer on the stage of international politics. And in my book, I document a number of religious leaders in the Middle East who have also rediscovered Article 29. Put this one up for a second. And in doing so, their support for inclusive citizenship and religious freedom is coupled with strong emphasis on duties and responsibilities and the role played by the state and religious authorities in generating political virtues and social cohesion. Few of these declarations, it could be noted, particularly those emanated from the Middle East, mention democracy or recommend limits on state power. This is a recent document, 2019, the Charter of the New Alliance of Virtue, which explicitly, right as it starts to talk about positive and accountable citizenship, argues that citizenship is predicated upon liberty, equality, pluralism, and mutual respect, but also, and here they explicitly tie the exercise of rights to Article 29 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now, while naming these tensions, I don't want to argue that this ambivalence is necessarily debilitating, nor that democracy is or should be necessarily the end goal of these efforts. Most of the declarations neither condemn nor advocate for democracy. Rather, I understand them as being designed to orient or as attempts to orient diverse societies towards common ideals on citizenship, pluralism, and religious freedom, and to motivate international cooperation on that basis. And in doing so, I think that these declarations have facilitated broader efforts by religious traditions to come to terms with late modernity in ways which preserve or make possible a strong religious account of society and politics, one which also promotes human rights and freedoms. And I remain generally very hopeful on that account. All right, so that's my book in a nutshell. Just checking, okay, so we're doing pretty good on time. Now, what does all that have to say about interreligious engagement efforts after October 7th? Or how the interreligious landscape has changed since October 7th and its aftermath? There's a number of ways that we could try to begin to answer that question. From a scholarly perspective, which was ultimately the aim of the book, I think that there are a number of empirical questions which could be asked, and I think that the framework of my book helps to formulate and begin to answer some of them. For example, using the levels of analysis adopted in the book, I think it would be important to track and measure whether states will continue to support interreligious engagement in the region as a result of the last 4 months. Will interreligious dialogue remain useful for their international, for their national interests and for their geopolitical strategies? I also think it'll be important to ask whether the ideas which have emerged from this set of interreligious engagement initiatives will also last. Will they continue to impact religious and political visions in the region? And finally, I also think, following the levels of analysis, that it'll be important to ask whether these initiatives and ideas will remain in tune with the evolution of religious and social positions, which are inevitably developing out of this moment of violence and crisis. On the first question, while we can recognize the possibility that states may abandon or flip dialogue projects when they become irksome, that was the case in Turkey in the mid-2010s, My prediction is that I don't think that that will be the case here. I think that states in the region, and particularly states in the Gulf, will continue to view these dialogue channels as being useful, including for their relationship with the West, the possibilities of multi-religious collaboration and cooperation, which it promises, and so on. So far, I think it's been striking the extent to which Saudi Arabia, in particular, has held on to the potential of the Abraham Accords, as has the United Arab Emirates, as I'll come back to in just a second. On the second question, will these ideas last? I think they will remain relevant. The internal logic is consistent, it's coherent, and it's out of the bag, so to speak. It could be ignored, it could go in an increasingly conservative direction and interpretation, but I think the language and vision will remain, and remain somehow a recalibrating device for a number of movements. Finally, on the last question, will dialogue remain attractive socially or religiously as an innovative practice, as a harbinger of priests? Here, I'm more unsure. I think that it's difficult in this moment to fully register the rage within Arab societies towards the West as a result of the violence in Gaza. And I don't think we know exactly how that will impact views from within societies in the Middle East on democracy, on political freedom, on religious beliefs, and et cetera. Will we see, for example, a drop in support for democracy in the Middle East as a result of this war? Will social attitudes about dialogue and religious pluralism be tarred by association as well? How will this change the religious life and the aspirations, the religiosity of Muslim communities in the Middle East going forward? I think these are all really important empirical questions that we should be asking ourselves as scholars. At the same time, on some level, I also realize that they're unsatisfactory because of the overwhelming normative questions which are at play here, because of the unbearable suffering, because of the unhuman lives which are at stake right now. This conflict, this violence, inevitably interrogates dialogue efforts and poses difficult questions which must challenge dialogue actors and initiatives. Many, in fact, would see this explosion of violence and war as an indicator of the failure of dialogue to fully impact and influence the region, to create stable peace, to seriously address the Palestinian question, or to inspire real political reform. Why continue to invest in dialogue? What can interreligious dialogue do for peace today? I don't know, but I'll try to reflect. So a couple of reflections on that. The first thing is that I think it's important to recognize that this interfaith movement, the one that I chart in the book, is indeed already implicated in the region's politics and in this particular peace process in complex ways, especially if we take the example of the Abraham Accords, which I talked about earlier on. Recently, Muhammad Al-Issa, who is the head of the Muslim World League, who is a Saudi national, who was previously Saudi Arabia's Minister of Justice, and who has been very active and consistent on the interfaith front. He led, for example, on the creation of the 2018 Charter of Mecca, which was very much trying to position itself within these interreligious declarations. He organized important interreligious visits to Auschwitz and has vocally denounced attempts to deny the Holocaust. Earlier this year in January, he wrote a widely circulated Economist article, which I imagine many of you saw, calling for interreligious leadership, for moderation, and for resistance to exclusivist political theologies. Now, this call could be read as precisely drawing on the sets of ideas, networks, and aspirations which I try to lay out in my book. At the same time, he could also be seen to reflecting Saudi interests in the conflict, interest for a rapid end to the war in a way that preserves possibility of an eventual normalization of relations with Israel. So we have these complexities, and I think there's a sort of wide-reigning cognitive dissonance in the air that's difficult to overcome in this regard, especially among many religious and interreligious leaders, and which has slowed the response to this call, which has to do, I think, with, on the one hand, a genuine rising support of religious leaders for interreligious dialogues, who invested genuinely in this project and who tried to lay claim to a position as advocates of peace in doing so, and on the other hand, the renewal of this brutal, horrendous violence. Now, one way to resolve this dissonance is to reduce the entire project to geopolitics and to call out the injustice therein, to say that this was just a sham project. But as I hope my presentation has made clear, I think that's a simplistic way out, which really does not take the religious and social content of these initiatives seriously. My own view is that these efforts and the vision it has developed offers an important and creative resource, which I think has been left relatively untapped so far in this conflict. As I've just tried to argue, in the face of a period characterized by terrifying levels of violence, by the rise of the Islamic State, and dramatic new social pressures by the Arab Spring, religious and interreligious leaders forged a positive vision of political and religious development rooted in calls to human dignity, religious pluralism, freedom, and citizenship. And that's no small thing, and wasn't there before. That political imagination, if we could call it like that, continues to represent a serious blueprint, I think, for what a durable peace in the region could look like. That to create lasting peace within the region, within Israel, within Palestine, and between the two, we need the development of more inclusive practices of citizenship, as these actors have already committed themselves to. And here I would note that courageous interreligious voices have been calling for something very similar along these lines. Palestinian friend and colleague Mohammed Abu Nimr from the Salam Peace Institute has forcefully called on interreligious leadership, which was not so dramatically different from that of Muhammad Alisa, and which on some level simply tries to apply the response to the early phase of conflict, which I tried to outline in my talk today, to this current violence. I think that interreligious actors have been bewildered by violence in the Middle East today and unsure about how to move forward given their investment and friendships built up in interreligious work and their sensitivity, I think, to accusations that peace is a poor substitute for justice in the current situation. So this represents an unexpectedly dark, violent turn, which requires interreligious dialogue to reformat itself. And that will require courage and a lot of work. But I think as the religious response to the Islamic State shows, that courage has been mustered before and an important response has been made. I think that interreligious actors in some ways are the best position to speak credibly in the name of peace. And that this body of work they have built enables them to do so in a way which does not cede either political or religious terrain to exclusivists, that they're well positioned to make calls for peace and justice in a way that resists both anti-Semitic and Islamophobic framings of the conflict. Now, in order to do that, I think that religious voices could constantly appeal that the war is not an answer here, that suffering must stop, that humanitarian aid needs to be delivered, and that we need a ceasefire, that both Israel and Palestine have a future in the region, and that peace will require a system built on the mutual recognition of all parties' dignity. I'm inspired by Pope Francis and others' work in this regard, and I think he and others are proof that these declarations are alive and meaningful, and they are keeping a flame burning for eventual processes of reconciliation. Peace has to be remade, and that will require bridges, and in many ways, these interreligious dialogue leaders are bridges, remain bridges in the region today. In other words, I think that interreligious dialogue and this vision, characterized by what I call the dignity, freedom, citizenship principle, may be more important than ever in the work of peace in the region, whether or not dialogue actors are up for that task. And whatever the future of dialogue may be, from a scholarly perspective, turn to the perspective of the book, I hope that I've at least made a case that these initiatives, these actors, and these ideas represent an important moment in the global development of religion in late modernity and its role within international politics, and therefore should continue to require our research attention and efforts in political science and in other years and in other fields for years to come. Thank you very much, and look forward to conversation.
Michael, thank you for that masterful overview. Madawi, can we come to you now?
Can you hear? Okay. Thank you, Michael, for a very clear presentation. And it's not surprising, given that I very much enjoyed reading the book. And I strongly recommend the book, especially for PhD students who are writing their survey of the literature. Michael summarizes complex ideas that had developed over time, and he presents them critically. but it's so clear that a lot of graduate students would benefit, even if you are not, your case study is completely different from what is presented in the book. So thank you for giving us sort of a critical essay at the beginning of the book that gives us an idea about how the intellectual field developed with regard to interfaith dialogue. And the second point I want to say, I do appreciate your enthusiasm and positive hopes that interfaith dialogue can be not the only one, but one of the ways where communities and states could live in peace. So that's very clear in the book that Michael is for interfaith dialogue. There's no doubt about it. He makes that clear, and it is in every page. You can feel the enthusiasm that he has for the project of interfaith dialogue. Now, let me go to the other side of the story. I'm going to comment on simply Saudi Arabia because I'm more familiar with it. Maybe slightly on the UAE and the projects that are described in the book. These are two state-sponsored projects, and they have emerged in the most authoritarian dictatorships in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The UAE is not just Dubai. It's a very, very authoritarian state that prohibits freedom of speech, that monitors everything. Even WhatsApp is not allowed. You can't call someone on WhatsApp because it has to go through the right channel to be monitored. Saudi Arabia is the same. They both invest heavily in spying technology that they buy from Israel and other countries. So basically, I was shocked when Saudi Arabia, the country that I know, started the interfaith dialogue under King Abdullah. To say the least, each king in Saudi Arabia wanted his name to be associated with some grand project, whether it's a football stadium or a sort of a soft power. And King Abdullah was under a lot of pressure after 9/11 from the US and the US media and the Western world in general to do something about it. So he started two things, something domestically called the National Dialogue, and the other thing was the center in Vienna, out of all places. It was in Vienna. It was a dialogue between Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Obviously, Hindus, Buddhists didn't count, were not invited to that because they were regarded as outside the realm of the people of the book, the Abrahamic faiths. Leave that aside, in Saudi Arabia, as Michael documents clearly, nobody really took that seriously. In fact, they boycotted the project because it was at the height of what we call radical Islam. The country was under a strong wave of terrorism, and it was basically impossible to talk about dialogue. The whole Al-Qaeda slogan was remove the infidels from the Arabian Peninsula, which meant removing the Christians and the Jews and the Hindus and the Buddhists and everybody else, like eradicating them. And many people in Saudi Arabia, as we know, obviously did not subscribe to that line, but it was a substantial minority on the fringe of Islam. The difference between the UAE and Saudi Arabia is that Saudi Arabia is a country that is founded on radical Islam by the name of Wahhabiyya. The UAE, Islam was not something important. They joined the wave of political Islam in the 70s by sponsoring mosques, by sending missions, etc., for legitimacy, because every Arab state did exactly that, including Saudi Arabia, Egypt, everybody did it. So the Saudi initiative, I have a problem trying to agree with you, Michael, by saying that the Saudi initiative was a product of a global, wide-ranging modernity that is post-Islamist, post-secularist. We can't talk about post-secularist in Saudi Arabia. In fact, even secularism in the West is a bit debated. And I do remember the sociology of religion had a lot to say about the secularism of the West or the myth of it. In terms of the Muslim world, Asif Bayat did invent the word post-Islamist, which is basically Islamists decided that they will not call for an Islamic state, they would call for human rights. And he based his theory about the reformist in Iran. It doesn't mean that it's everywhere in the Arab world. But what really surprised me is that King Abdullah was promoting interfaith dialogue. And the people who would have helped in that project, the modernists in Saudi Arabia, were in prison. They put them in prison. And I wrote a book about them, and called the title was The Muted Modernists. These are the ones who focused on citizenship, on human rights, on democracy. If they were outside prison, they would have probably supported the interfaith dialogue. But they were all put in prison simply because they founded a civil society organization by the name of Hassan. In Saudi Arabia, civil society is banned. You cannot establish an independent organization. So that's the shocking thing about interfaith dialogue, is it comes at a time when a religion is under the control of the state. The modernist intellectuals and religious scholars were in prison. So that's the one thing. And also there's the problem of heightened sectarianism in Saudi Arabia at the time, and still now. So Sunnis, everybody thinks that Saudi Arabia is a Sunni country, but it is not. There are variations within the world of Islam in the Arabian Peninsula, and Saudi Arabia has a Shia community, it has an Ismaili community, it has a Sufi community, and their struggle for equality with the dominant state-controlled religion goes back like more than 100 years. So in the interfaith dialogue, you have a dialogue with people who do not have a strong presence in the country as natives, but you exclude Sunni-Shia dialogue. So until the present moment, there is no religious representatives of the Shia community in the Higher Council of Ulama, which is the Higher Council of Religious Scholars. They apply their fiqh, their Islamic jurisprudence in their own area, but they have no national representation. The final thing I want to mention is, which was really interesting, at the time of all this interfaith dialogue, there was talk in Western countries about why don't these Islamists turn themselves into Christian Democrats? So they can be socially conservative, they could wear the veil, they could, you know, have four wives if they want, but in the public sphere, they have to behave in a democratic way. And the targeted group were the Muslim Brotherhood that participated in many democratic elections and won seats in Morocco, in Kuwait, in Egypt. In Saudi Arabia, there are no elections, so they are banned, and now they're all in prison. So the problem, Hamas also was considered at one more time, like they can become Christian Democrats and behave in a democratic way by election. They did. But obviously, you know, they were excluded and they became like a state within Gaza that is ostracized by everybody, apart from, you know, some countries in the Middle East and also abroad. So what we make as an anthropologist, I find these arguments really fail to explain the context of these countries and the specificity of these societies. Not everything has to be modeled according to a Western Christian model. And therefore, you know, if you want to expect the Muslim Brotherhood to behave like a Christian democratic political party, then you have to have the democratic grounds for it to grow into that. Not every time they win election, you say like, oh, they're gonna win elections one time and never again, they're gonna sit in power. So we have to widen our understanding of these societies so that we don't think they are going to follow a Western model and the development of religion throughout Europe, because not everything will have to follow the pattern in Europe, not as a, as an objection or as an or sort of you know something not to have. If they develop, they develop. But there are local contexts that we need to take into account that may or may not correspond to our understanding of how religion and state should be. And I always go back to the work of Talal Asad, who is incredibly powerful in showing us that not everything has to follow the Western Christian history. So that's extremely important. And finally, just on the 7th of October, and whether this, I'm surprised that you're very optimistic about the merit of interfaith dialogue in the current situation of violence, even if violence stops tomorrow. I think, what we have seen in the last, since October, is that religious groups, especially in Israel, have become vocal about what they really think. And I see that religion is used to justify the violence that is taking place. When a prime minister says that he is following the Torah and what God instructed the king to eradicate people, to kill their animals, to poison their wells, to do all that, when this is invoked by a politician, anchoring the violence that has happened in Gaza in religious grounds, and the same thing goes on the other side. I don't really see how religion can be a cause for peace or help peace. In fact, the more religion is taken out of it, the better, simply because political conflicts can be resolved without bringing the sacred in. And once you bring the sacred, we know Jerusalem is the sacred. It can't be divided because you can't divide the sacred. You share it sometimes, without actually liking it. But if the conflict is phrased in political terms, I have more hope that it will actually be resolved. The more it is anchored in religion, the less likely it's going to be resolved, simply because these religious feelings seem to be to justify. Religious texts are used to justify murder and eradication, uprooting and extermination of people, exactly like Al-Qaeda did, exactly like ISIS did. They could take a text from the Quran out of context and interpret it literally in order to kill. And the Jewish settlers in the West Bank and the ones who are hoping to go to Gaza are doing exactly that, taking text from the West from the Torah or wherever they have them and applying them in this conflict.
Thank you. Lots of provocation for you there, Michael. Fabio, should we come to you?
Yes, thank you. Well, just Michael, thank you very much for having written this book. I think you really have told us a story that had to be told, the story of this proliferation of interreligious initiatives, declaration, activities in that part of the world, in particular in the Middle East, and you have very skillfully, explained to us the very complex context, which is geopolitical, but which is also, as you said, religious and social, and that has to do, of course, with 9/11, wouldn't deny, has to do with everything that you said. And actually, I don't think Michael will disagree, for example, to explain why Saudi Arabia has been engaged in this state-sponsored, he called them interreligious initiatives. It's clearly more on the geopolitical side of the equation. But however, you also, and that's where, have explained how other cases of interreligious solidarity and collaborations, the ones that are more grassroots, the one like ADIAN Foundation Lebanon or the Focolare in Algeria, how much they have to do much more with changes, very deep changes that are happening in within religious tradition, in dialogue with societal changes. The Arab Spring you mentioned. So I think you have reconstructed a very complex picture, and thank you for doing this. This is really, really important. I just want to add, I mean, I broadly, you know, agree with much of the argument you have put. I want to add a little bit more of how I see some of these things. For me, there is a broader context in which, in a simplified way, and that speaks also to what you were saying, Madhva, we are seeing in a very intense way the political ambivalence of religion. On one hand, we are seeing the increasing religious nationalism, polarization, religious-based sectarian violence, even holy wars. You know, because I think the language of holy wars, unfortunately, whether it's Russia, whether it's Israel, whether it's Gaza, you know, is proliferating. So we see this incredibly worrying trend of religions become a part of political conflict and violence. But, and that's what I'm, at the same time, we see that some of the most powerful voices of counter-narrative are also religious one, and are voices of religious leaders speaking together against some of these trends. So, you know, there is this broader, and here I think, you know, remember, I think that the Declaration of Human Fraternity that you mentioned, Michael, between two great, very important religious leaders, Pope Francis and the Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar al-Tayyib, was done as a reaction against Daesh and what was happening. You know, and I think was a, you know, one of the few voices of hope for the region in saying we can reject this on religious ground and do something different, build an inclusive society. So I mean, I think this is the what I would call this the international context of the religious political nexus. You know, it's so, the political ambivalence of the sacred is in front of us. And I think this puts a huge responsibility nowadays on religious leaders, because we see growingly politicians using religious, but these are not religious actors. And we need to be, a religious leader at some point will need to come out, and they do, but we'll need to, you know, delegitimize the use of religion in this kind of things away. So, you know, this is, there is a very important, and that's why I think also why it's important actually to understand that there is a genuine new interreligious movement, interreligious dialogue and collaboration that has been growing. And this is a kind of a very new phenomenon, you know. It's not only anymore the phenomenon of the leaders of religions meeting in big conferences, exchanges, kisses, and saying how much they share in common. It's much more. It's collaboration going on the ground in a very kind of societal way among, I would say, very interestingly, you have proved this, youth and women. So the agencies that you will not associate, and this is a very important globally happening, and at the same time, this is one of, and in fact, I think one of the main changes is interreligious dialogue and collaboration from theological exchange high level going to grassroots social collaboration. Then there is another important thing. Policymakers, politicians, and you know, the ones who are, and there are, hopefully wants peace and wants human rights and sustainable development, they have finally recognized that there is a potential in these dynamics. So, you know, they are ready to try to engage constructively. They don't know really how. They do many mistakes, but they realize this is something that can be part of building more inclusive society, more sustainable society, more peaceful society. And so that's something where we need to think a little bit more how to do that, but I think it's another important development. And the other interesting development that goes more to specifically the interreligious dynamics in the region, And I think that you, Michael, mentioned is that, you know, what was mostly a set of declaration among Christian, Jewish, Muslim leaders on condemning the justification of violence through religion, in the last decades has become also a recognition that this is not enough. Religion needs to stand, and this is a new development, on the equation of freedom. You know, so something like the statement on human fraternity that comes from the fact that we are brothers and sisters, that means we need to respect each other and recognize our reciprocal freedom. It's quite a shift theologically, and opens up possibility for thinking, you know, as you said, that even a religious argument can support citizenship and freedom. You know, it's a journey, but I think it's as significant, as you rightly say, when the Catholic Church was not in favor of religious freedom before the Second Vatican Council, was not really in favor of interreligious dialogue, and was struggling to accept democracy. That moment of theological changes, you know, brought all these streams together, and therefore recognizing that, you know, parallelism are always a little bit problematic, but I think something similar structurally may be happening in some streams of the religious landscape of the Middle East. Now, I have to say two more things. One is that I really liked a couple of chapters, Michael, of the book, which were really hopeful, and these are the ones on the Focolari community in Algeria and the Adyan Foundation. Here we are seeing something even, I would say, here I use a little bit more prophetic, something that looks at the future. Maybe, you know, here we are seeing people which say, we belong to the same spiritual community, but we remain yet Christian, Catholic, Focolari, and we remain Muslims, but we are sharing the same charisma of unity. That's very powerful. I don't know, but you know, this may be it's a seeds of hope, of unity, quite powerful, you know, very contextual, small, but I think it's something precious that might be speaking for something that will come at some point. And I wanted to highlight, because you have done this fantastic work of interviewing this young Muslim in Algeria who feels, you could say, at the same time Muslim and Catholics. You know, it's quite extraordinary if you think about that. But they feel, you know, belonging to this community. And so this is final points about since you put the issue of the October the 7th, of course, any discussion on religion and diplomacy in this context is very, very complicated and challenging. But I would want to say a couple of things, because Madawi, and this was really, let's not forget, the only kind of peace process, the Oslo peace process, which was the only attempt to have a peace agreement between Israel and Palestine, you know, never include not even one minor religious element. There was not even a consultation with the religious reality. And I think this was one of the great problem, this process, you know? So this idea that we use a secularist framework, remove religion from the picture and peace become more possible, is simply not what we have seen with reference to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So I really don't buy it. I actually found shocking that most of the picture associated to the famous Oslo Peace Agreement, you know, don't feature one religious person where in the Holy Land. Does this make any sense? This is a sort of, I don't know, Western secularist bias, to say the least, if I could put it like that. The other thing I believe is that, and I do hope we will get to a ceasefire as soon as possible in Gaza, but I personally believe that the role of religious leaders in Israel-Palestine will be more important than ever, because I think we will need more and more to talk about healing. I mean, what has been going on both sides is absolutely horrible and atrocity. How can you even start thinking about a long peace-building process if there is not some process of healing, reconciliation? And there, I actually think the religious leaders are much better placed to help this process. I don't know how, I don't want to under-evaluate the challenges of this, but I think when you look at reconciliation, forgiveness, what peace-building studies have proved in the last 20 years is actually that religious have resources that some other secular peace-building approaches do not have it. And I think we will need to mobilize that. And final things, I even think that in terms of mediation, given how much delegitimized the political national class, both in Israel and in the Palestinian side, as well as the policymakers that are supposed to mediate in the West, in Europe, are at the moment, I think alternative mediators will need to be looked for. I don't know if that means that perhaps some religious-based organization could help, but I don't think we can exclude that. And I'll conclude here. Thank you.
Thank you, Fabio. Now, Michael, there's a lot that's come up there that I'm sure you want to respond to, but cruelly, I'm not going to allow you because we've got 20 minutes and I really want to hear from this audience in front of us. And I suspect that a lot of the same kinds of themes are going to come up in the questions. So is it okay for you to weave that into the questions from the audience? I'm going to take them in clusters of threes. If you could please say your name, and if you have any affiliation, if you're studying here, whatever, and then please give us a question because we just don't have time for speeches. Over to you. Let's start here, and then, okay, well, Richard, warm us up.
Yeah. Hi, Richard Sudworth, Church of England. The parallel was made to Vatican II, Nostra Aetate, Dignitatis Humanae, coming out of a crisis. What you have there is the self-criticism of the church's own history. When I read the state-sponsored documents in framing interfaith relations, apart from the Indonesian document on humanity, I don't see any self-criticism. So the ambivalence that Fabio pointed to, I'd love to hear what you think about the necessary aspect of self-criticism for religions to do political diplomacy in this context.
Shall we? Yes, let's go to Toby there.
Thank you very much, Toby Green. I'm a visiting fellow in the Middle East Centre. Thanks for really interesting presentations. We heard a bit about the role that Arab state sponsorship of religious leadership in the West in the 1970s promoted kind of conservative religious leadership. Now we obviously see this new wave that Dr. Dreesen has described. Does that also have a potential to? First of all, there's a question about its potential to influence within the region itself, Islamic views within the region. But does it also have an opportunity to influence attitudes? Among Muslim communities in the West, in Europe, and other Western countries, does it have the potential to project in that sense also?
And then, if we can go to the very back row in the black.
Hello, Anna. I study management, so I'm really not an expert on the topic. So my question would be, how does this dialogue work when you reason from very different ideologies? So I, as an agnostic person, for example, struggle a lot to kind of have a discussion on topics when the counterpart sort of, I don't know, reasons through ideology that is religious, for example, in cases like abortions, but also now in the Gaza conflict. So that would be my question.
So Michael, do you want to kick off responding and then we'll come to other panelists if they want to add anything?
Sure. Can you hear me? Yeah.
No,
should I respond to some of these questions as well, or you want me to? It's okay if I take some time to respond to some of these.
Yeah, go on then. Go on then.
No.
No, they're really well. First of all, thank you for reading the book. It's as a scholar, it's a lonely enterprise. So I really appreciate the engagement. So maybe just a couple points. Maybe start off particularly with Mandawi, who raised an important set of points. I'm fully aware of the paradox of Saudi Arabia as a sponsor of interreligious dialogue. I mean, this is if there's the one country in the world which is not doing much on the religious freedom front, it's Saudi Arabia. You can't build a church or a temple, as you point out. So it's a paradox, but yet they're doing it. And so that raises questions about why. I'll leave that there for a second. The post-Islamism and the question of democracy, I want to be clear that I don't think that Saudi Arabia, in investing in these dialogue processes, in any way, shape, form, interested in becoming democratic or will become democratic anytime soon. I don't think that's the right way to look at this, and I think we'd be fooled if we were thinking of that. Where I think post-Islamism is very useful, well, it's useful for many different ways, but let me just name one. I like Asif Bayat's work a lot. I think if you look at the early 2000s, where you first start to see dialogue initiatives emerging within the Muslim majority world, they're all emerging in, as you said, reformist kinds of places. So he was working on post-Islamism in Iran, and Khatami was, you know, and so there was a sort of a post-Islamist reformist movement, but not just there. Also in Turkey, where you have the early period of the AKP and its early reformist moment, that's also where you see the Gulen movement emerging at the same time in a similar sort of moment. And you also see it in places like Malaysia and in Indonesia as well. So you have four or five major experiences of political reform and dialogue happening at the same time, which I think is somehow captured by this post-Islamist sensibility. Now, one way to read Saudi Arabia's, which we could also connect to Qatar through its sponsorship of Qaradawi. So one way in which you can read, I think, Saudi Arabia's sponsorship of interreligious dialogue is exactly to hold off competition with the reformist movement. So it's a sort of investing competitively in interreligious dialogue as a way to block the rise of Muslim democracy, or Muslim reformism, or Muslim Brotherhood, whatever it is, which looks like it's growing in strength in the early 2000s and then explodes in the Arab Spring. So I think that's definitely what's going on. Now, they're also sponsoring ideas which are being picked up and coming out of those reform movements. So the ideas of citizenship, again, they're not interested in citizenship in the sense, and the democratic sense, and I don't think that's, again, the right lens to go through, but they are sponsoring citizenship. And Tarek Masood has a great article on this where he's sort of playing around with this paradox. And he wonders, you know, whether or not the extent to which Saudi Arabia investing in citizenship will create contradictions which will force some sort of change later on. He rejects a modernization theory where you have investment in economics and citizenship. He thinks that they are investing in citizenship as a way to mobilize citizens for their national project. But I'm not convinced that Saudi Arabia controls this process either. I think that Saudi Arabia has put into play and articulated and sponsored ideas which down the road, not necessarily in Saudi Arabia, but will have an influence. The role of religious reason. I'm not optimistic. I am optimistic, but I'm optimistic by nature. But I'm not optimistic about religious leaders in the conflict today. I don't think that's the way I see it. I do think, and I think Fabio was articulating this, I do think that interreligious leaders are in an important position to try to deconstruct some of those religious arguments that you were making. And I think it's going to be very difficult for secular states to do that. I think that has to come from within, and it's been a process which these religious leaders and interreligious leaders have been engaged in with over the last 20 years, that they've been trying to deconstruct religious arguments that ISIS or others have been making about violence. So I think they are in a position to do so, even if they're not, or not enough of them are. But I think ultimately, I mean, on some level, and I also agree with Madawi that religion is not the answer here. This is requires a political solution. We should not overwrite or overemphasize religion in the conflict. But I think interreligious leaders, have an important play, particularly in deconstructing these arguments. Fabio, I agree with much of what Fabio said. I don't want to belabor. One thing about the this idea of democracy, again, I'd be very careful about these parallels. Somebody asked about, so I'm going to connect between Fabio and Richard, and then keep on moving, about the Nostra Aetate and the sort of the parallels to the Catholic Church. Great question, the extent to which you require self-criticism. It's true that the Catholic Church is self-critical in Vatican II, but up to a point. That would be the first thing I would say. And a lot of the readings of, you know, within the right, the post-liberal right on some level, within Christian circles today, Catholic sovereignty circles today, go back to Vatican II, particularly Dignitatis Humanae, and fish out of that a more integralist Catholic view that is also there, which still reaffirms that the Catholic Church is the one true faith. So political freedom and really political freedom, but we're still the one true faith. So they're bringing forward Orthodox Catholic ideas in a democratic context, but still clearly emphasizing. Self-criticism itself is also, going back to Tal al-Assad, is itself a sort of, could be thought of as a liberal, secular sort of exercise. So here I think Madawi is exactly right. As much as I like the parallel, and I think that it's important to see the parallels, I like to try to just let this process be. I'm interested in seeing what this process will create. And I think it is creating or attempting to construct something different. I mean, there's something else. Some new Muslim modernity is in the making. Multiple Muslim modernities are in the making. And I think this is an important part of that process. Let me just respond to the two other, and then I'll let for more. I can't remember her name. Great question. Let me just say that, yes, I do think it can, it has an influence, it can influence. I know from, so I live in Italy, I work with Muslim groups in Italy, and from speaking with them, they have been immensely encouraged and founded to be very helpful, these declarations and these statements, and they've been teaching them, and they've been, it's given them also confidence in who they are and their message and sort of synteny. So one of the elements which I explore in my book is the Chart of Medina, which has been sort of re-proposed as a sort of a Magna Carta of the Muslim majority world. And that has been very helpful for reading groups and for small groups and also for sort of public posturing. Anecdotally, speaking with some of my colleagues in Italy, they have said that in their mosques, some of this literature has been, been placed, and that has been very helpful. But I think more research. So that's, you know, anecdotally. Finally, big question on. One thing is that there is a great field, and James and others could speak much more to this about religious secular dialogue, which I think is really interesting and important and possible. What I'm talking about in the Middle East, there's not very much religious secular, religious agnostic dialogue, but certainly I think it's a very fruitful way. And I think dialogue sets up a place, an uninhabited space where those types of encounters are possible. Thank
you. So there was a hand over here. Yes, so we go to you. And then we'll come to you.
Hi. Thank you for the presentation. I'm Yuper Soy from IR department. I'm a visiting fellow here. I have a question before that. In December, the Archbishop of Munich, Cardinal Reinhard Marx, made some statements and they became like popular or unpopular. He said if a religion supports groups like Hamas, it becomes part of the religion. And he added, stop this religion. He didn't say stop Hamas, he said, stop this religion. So my question is in this, and related to the necessity of self-criticism in religions, my question is in these cases of anti-dialogue discourse, what should be done?
Okay, thank you. And then this gentleman here.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Jia Yu Liang. I am a graduate from the University of Sussex. And well, thank you, Michael, for your presentation. And I have a question to Michael, but inspired by the comments of Madawi and Fabio. That is, I'm wondering whether you can tell us about the place of intra-religious dialogue in interreligious dialogue, because Malawi talks about the usage of text to justify killing an old, but that is obviously, that obviously deals with how particular texts were interpreted within a religion, right? There can be more than one interpretation, and that also relates to the role of religious leader can play in the conflicts now. So yeah, great. That's my question, thanks.
Thank you. And then I think we've got time for... No, well, that's very good. Cora, go on, have the last question, go on. My PhD student's allowed.
Yeah, Cora, a PhD student at the IR department. Super interesting presentation. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the West or Western government's responses to initiatives such as Qaiseed, because especially after Jamal Khashoggi's murder, I mean, Qaiseed, for example, was kicked out of Austria and is now located in Portugal. And I think within foreign departments, there have been conversations about how to collaborate, work with, partner with initiatives such as Qaiseed. So I was just wondering if you could give us a little bit of a picture of what the latest is.
Thank you. Great questions. And so let me group these first two, which in some ways are both about inter-religious dialogue on some level. I was not familiar with this, statement by Karl Marx. Most likely needs to be put within the context of the German context, where there's, Habermas himself has made controversial statements, as you probably know. So what do we do about anti-dialogue? Well, here gets to Chai Lu. Intra-religious dialogue is more difficult than inter-religious dialogue on many levels. Not always, but and so we have to take that seriously. I resist the sort of, there's a debate within studies of dialogue about how much, the extent to which dialogue itself has an impact, the act of dialogue itself has an impact on people being together. Does dialogue itself, including intra-religious dialogue, inevitably lead towards some sort of progressive emancipative vision? I think that was a view that was pretty dominant in the early 2000s, late 1990s. I'm much more ambivalent about that. I think that dialogue is an interesting process, it's an important process, but it's also ultimately an open-ended process. So it's a place where people have a positive debate looking for some sort of minimal level of religious peace between them. So I think intra-religious dialogue is possible, but I don't think it will necessarily lead to some sort of progressive peace movement. It could very well, and in fact, I mentioned my colleague, Christina Stoickel, we're sort of at this really interesting moment where some of the inter-religious dialogue that I'm talking about is going in a very different direction. So I'm working on a new project that looks at connections between inter-religious dialogue and national populism. Surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, Viktor Orban has been moving around to certain different dialogue circles because he sees within those dialogue circles natural allies in certain policies. So what does that mean? Well, it means that the dialogue continues, and I don't think we know exactly where it's going to end up. And as a scholar, I feel pretty comfortable leaving it at that. Cora, very good question on Western responses. Like I said, I wrote a smart article on this. So for those of you who are following Khashoggi's murder, there was, Qaiseed was kicked out of Vienna where they were based. The general argument is that we as people in the West, we in Vienna cannot be seen to be legitimizing Qaiseed's instrumentalization of, we have to say no to them at every single level, and therefore we can't allow them to have this project which allows them to think that they're a human rights sort of promoting. And I think that was kind of where the argument went. I talked to a lot of people in Qaiseed, I interviewed a lot of them, and I interviewed a lot of people in the interreligious dialogue world, and nobody thought that was a good idea. Almost everybody to a T who I talked to thought that that was, almost everybody to a T who I talked to, including at high levels, were happy that Saudi Arabia was investing in this dialogue. Even if it's instrumental, even if they are somehow also making it possible for dialogue to progress. People are being involved in dialogue process who 20 years ago just simply would not have been involved in the dialogue process. A colleague of mine, I think very succinctly said, look, for 20 years I was working for the United States, and when I went back to the Arab world, everybody was asking me, why can you still, he was working at the United States Institute of Peace, how can you work for the United States of U.S. Institute of Peace? And he said, that's the way I feel about working with Qaiseed. I don't agree with Saudi Arabia's policies, but I see this as an important vehicle for change. And what did Vienna win by kicking Qaiseed out? They lost, you know, one small little institute that Saudi Arabia was investing in. I'll leave it at that. I see James is asking me. So thank you, everyone.
When I was reading your book, Michael, I thought like there were memories around the same time when they established the institute in Vienna. I was doing research among British Muslims and transnational connections with Saudi Arabia. And I went to several mosques in London and in West London and in London, small mosques, not the big ones. And I came across a fatwa. Fatwa is a religious decree issued by one of the highest level religious scholars in Saudi Arabia. It's a council that includes several of those ulama, obviously all appointed by the king. And the fatwa said, addressing British Muslims, and it dates to year 2000, the millennial celebration, asking British Muslims not to send any cards and congratulate Christians for year 2000, and never go and participate in their funerals because you might develop love for them. This is a fatwa issued by a Saudi scholar under the auspices of the Saudi state that is distributed in London and in Birmingham. So then I get to the news that there is the interfaith dialogue and Saudi Arabia is now a champion of interfaith dialogue. So it's very difficult to reconcile the two. Things have changed in Saudi Arabia, and now the interfaith dialogue is not on the agenda. You mentioned religious washing.
Religion washing
as soft power. Now we are into a different sports washing rather than religion. Religion is not taking precedence in Saudi Arabia. So that's one thing. And then another just point about, as I understood that the peace process, the agreements, the accords from the Abrahamic Accords, the latest to Camp David, did not include any religious people, representative of religious communities, and probably this is why they failed, or they didn't have the success. I think they, I can see, I don't want to be representing the secular point of view, but the people who signed from the Arab world these peace agreements, they're all unelected people, like the religious scholars. They represent a very small community. There are so many of them. And what mandate do they have? I mean, the politicians and the religious scholars. And it is not a guarantee that if they had religious scholars, then we'll have, you know, understanding and sort of, you know, better. The reason why these peace agreements failed is because they are meant to ensure that no Palestinian state exists. And, you know, all the talk about two-state solution, I mean, if you read Seth, he's a scholar at UCL, he's a Jewish American academic historian, he looks at all the peace processes, and he proves, relying on documents in Israel and the Mossad, which give the clear argument that these peace processes, Madrid, Oslo, Camp David, the recent ones, are meant not to allow a Palestinian state to exist.
Okay. We're over time. Fabio, quickly.
Yeah. No, just one point about the Qaiseed things. I mean, the interesting thing, of course, Saudi Arabia is not, as you the most welcoming place for interreligious dialogue, which cannot happen within the territory of Saudi Arabia. However, the work that CAISID has been doing has been extremely important. And the number of fellows and young scholars who have been there internationally. So here there is a paradox, you know. With the closure of CAISID, we have lost something very important in terms of people having the opportunity to go and study there, be a fellow there from different young religions. And here the question is, okay, is Saudi clearly doing this as a washing exercise? But, you know, at some point, this washing exercise is producing some positive kind of dynamics for international coexistence at multiple levels. So, you know, this is how life can be messy. But I think the kind of activity CAISID was doing were very high quality in terms of the kind of pluralism. And the problem here, I think, and that goes, the final things I want to say, I mean, we live in this political moment of great polarization in which, you know, the world. But, you know, dialogue means basically engaging the person you really disagree with you. And it's a political dialogue means how can you do political dialogue without the enemies? You know, I think, unfortunately, we are entering, we have been entering this polarized ideological environment where some of the views that are also the views of the tradition of nonviolence and peace building, in which, you know, you try to turn your enemy into your friend, as Gandhi will say, do not have much space. And I think we need to recover that because, you know, to build peace, you need to speak with your enemies. And that's something you cannot escape from.
Good word to end on. The interfaith dialogues will go on. And I think what we've concluded tonight is that the dialogues about the dialogues also need to carry on and certainly will do. I'll just end by thanking all of you for coming, taking part in this discussion, but particularly our panel, Michael Madawi and Fabio. Thank you so much.